The following program is made possible with grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Additional funds from Saul and Stanley Zabar, in memory of their parents, Louis and Lillian Zabar, Russian immigrants who founded Zabar's more than 70 years ago. Zabar's, a New York landmark, supplies food and delicacies to New Yorkers and to the nation, on the web at zabars.com. Additional support from Edwin A. Goodman, Harvey and Thelma Reisman, the John L. Loeb Jr. Foundation, from Frost, Zelnick, Lehrman, and Zissou, specializing in intellectual property law for clients worldwide, on the web at frostzelnick.com, and from one anonymous donor.
This is Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. I'm Larry Josephson.
Dear friends, 10 days ago, Al Gore asked me to be his running mate.
This was a milestone in American Jewish history. A Jew, Joe Lieberman, chosen by a major party to run for Vice President of the United States. American Jews have arrived, but it's been a long time coming. Throughout most of their history, the Jewish people have been excluded from the mainstream, wherever they lived. America has been the exception. Over time, and at great cost, inclusion has proved to be beneficial for Jews and for all immigrants, and for the country as a whole. Today, about 6 million Jews live in the United States. They're lawyers, doctors, scientists, artists, and baseball players. They're in business, entertainment, and politics. Most American Jews have roots in Eastern Europe. Their grandparents or great-grandparents came as part of a huge wave of immigration that brought more than 2 million Jews to the United States between 1881 and 1924. But the story of American Jews starts more than 350 years ago, long before most people realize. You're listening to The First Jews, part of the series Only in America, 350 years of the American Jewish experience. The story of Jews in America begins in September 1654, well before the American Revolution. 23 bedraggled, impoverished Jews arrive in the port of New Amsterdam, a Dutch settlement in Lower Manhattan. Their story began on the Iberian Peninsula in medieval Spain and Portugal. Rabbi Michael Paley.
The two great powers of the world were Spain and Portugal. Until 1580, the Catholic Church was the most significant aspect of the Spanish monarchy.
Ya vendrá el Señor de la redención a decir a todos vamos a Sion.
In 1492, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella issued a decree expelling the Jews from Spain.
Dr. Mark Angel is senior rabbi of Sherith Israel in New York.
The Jews were given an option: leave or accept Catholicism. Several hundred thousand Jews left, and others were lost to Judaism. In 1497, the Portuguese rulers also decided to outlaw open Jewish life in Portugal. So what happened was those Jews who could leave left.
Some of these exiled Jews went to Amsterdam. The Dutch were known for religious tolerance.
Some of them came to the New World with the Dutch West India Company and were settled in a city called Recife in Brazil.
Those Jews prosper in Recife, Brazil.
Rabbi Michael Paley.
You are getting the most free Jews that ever lived, maybe from the time of the expulsion by the Romans and probably before. So you're talking about a remarkable experience in Jewish life. And they continued to prosper, feeling unfettered for the first time, until the Portuguese come in and reconquer northern Brazil.
That meant they brought back the Inquisition, and in fact, they gave Jews as well as Protestants 3 months to leave.
Jonathan Sarna, professor of American Jewish history at Brandeis University.
Most of those Jews went back to Holland. Number go to communities in the Caribbean. But for reasons that are not altogether clear, these 23 found themselves on the way to New Amsterdam, and they enter the port of New Amsterdam, and they seek permission to live there and to be allowed to trade. There were only 4 men among the 23, the rest women and children.
When they first landed, they were terribly in debt to the ship captain. They had promised an enormous sum of money, which, of course, they did not have, being refugees from Recife. So the first record we have of Jews, in fact, are court cases where the ship captain was suing the Jews for payment. Several of the Jews were actually imprisoned, and their goods were confiscated to be sold at auction, that the captain should have full payment of the exorbitant fee which he exacted from them.
New Amsterdam was then a small settlement at the lower end of Manhattan. It was part of New Netherland, a series of trading posts along the Hudson River, governed by the Dutch West India Company. New Amsterdam was founded 30 years before the first Jews arrived. It was a bustling port town of 1,500 souls. Its northernmost boundary was Wall Street. Beyond was untouched wilderness. In 1654, Peter Stuyvesant was governor. Historian Jack Wertheimer.
Peter Stuyvesant was an ardent member of the Dutch Reformed Church.
From his perspective, there were already too many kinds of religious groups in New Amsterdam.
Jonathan Sarna.
He had been brought to the colony from Curaçao in order to bring order to this wild place by enforcing Calvinist orthodoxy and rooting out nonconformity.
Peter Stuyvesant, as well as other leaders of particular colonies, were motivated by a kind of exclusionary outlook. They wanted to maintain their colonies in their pristine state. They did not want to let in other Christians. So Catholics, for example, were given a much more difficult time by Peter Stuyvesant. And Quakers, for example, he hanged.
When the Jews arrived, he sought permission from Amsterdam, from the Dutch West India Company, to keep the Jews out altogether.
He politely, as they say, politely welcomed the Jews to leave.
Rabbi Mark Angel.
He wrote back to the Dutch West India Company in Amsterdam and said, there are some Jews who have arrived here. If we allow them to stay here, then what are we going to have? Lutherans, Quakers, Catholics, and who knows what.
September 22, 1654, to the directors of the Dutch West India Company. The Jews who have arrived would nearly all like to remain here, but learning that they, with their customary usury and deceitful trading with the Christians, were very repugnant to the inferior magistrates, we have deemed it useful to require them in a friendly way to depart. Praying also most seriously in this connection that this deceitful race, such hateful enemies and blasphemers of the name of Christ, be not allowed to further infect and trouble this new colony to the detraction of your worships and the dissatisfaction of your worships' most affectionate subjects.
There were a certain number of Jews who were stockholders in the Dutch West India Company and who were supporting the rights of their fellow Jews to remain in New Amsterdam. The Dutch West India Company, which suddenly had to choose between its economic interests and its religious sensibilities, voted with its pocketbook.
To Peter Stuyvesant, governor of New Amsterdam, April 26, 1655. We would have liked to effectuate and fulfill your wishes and request that the new territories should no more be allowed to be infected by people of the Jewish nation, for we foresee therefrom the same difficulties which you fear. But having further weighed and considered the matter, we observe that this would be somewhat unreasonable and unfair because of the large amount of capital which they still have invested in the shares of this company. Therefore, after many deliberations, we have finally decided and resolved that these people may travel and trade to and in New Netherland and live and remain there, provided the poor among them shall not become a burden to the company or to the community, but be supported by their own nation. You will now govern yourself accordingly.
Probably the most famous of the 23 is Asher Levy.
Jonathan Sarna.
Nobody's ever quite figured out how he got to Recife and then came to New Amsterdam. Apparently his roots went back to Vilna in Lithuania.
Probably the most significant thing about Levy is that he wants to stay. He wants to become a colonist.
Rabbi Michael Paley.
Whereas many of the other people thought that the Jews that came were passing through and that they would ultimately leave. And a lot of them did.
Peter Stuyvesant felt that Jews should not be allowed to serve guard duty because he didn't trust them, and instead Jews should have to pay so that somebody else should serve guard duty. Asher Levy opposed that, insisted on the right to serve guard duty with everybody else, and in fact won that right.
Hassia Diner, professor of American Jewish history at NYU.
When the Jews, Asher Levy in particular, is the kind of leader of this, ask for the right to serve in the militia, they're not asking for rights in any abstract sense. They're not saying, look, all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator, but rather it's going to be good for the society.
Despite the antipathy that existed in colonial America towards Jews, the barriers that had come into existence in medieval Europe, economic barriers, social barriers, these impeded Jews from engaging in various types of occupations in Europe, whereas in the New World, those barriers had not yet formed. And so Jews were able to do all kinds of things in the New World that in contemporary Europe they could not do.
Meyer Myers was the most productive silversmith in New York throughout the 1760s. Though not as well known as Paul Revere, Myers was well respected as a merchant artisan. His workshop produced candlesticks and bread baskets, as well as the Torah ornaments that are still used at Congregation Sherith Israel in New York City.
I think it can be fairly stated that the Jewish struggle for civil rights was the first civil rights battle on this continent.
Rabbi Mark Angel.
As those first 23 Jews and their successors fought for the simple elementary rights to function in society as equal citizens and finally won those rights, they set a foundation for the whole development of the American system. Of course, we had great political leaders like Thomas Jefferson, like George Washington, who had much more influence. But the influence of the Jewish community as a leavening agent should never be underestimated.
Jews were not the only religious minority struggling for freedom in the colonies. Susan Jacoby wrote Freethinkers, A History of American Secularism.
The religious landscape in America was almost entirely Christian, almost entirely Protestant. But within Protestantism, there was a great deal of difference. There were Quakers who had dissented from all of the established Protestant churches of Europe. There were French Huguenots who'd been driven out by the Catholics in France. There were Episcopalians. There were Baptists. There were Presbyterians. There were a lot of Protestants who really objected to each other's ideas.
The British take over New Amsterdam from the Dutch in 1664. They rename it New York.
The Jews are part of an international entrepreneurial system which produces cash for the colony. And the British are happy to have them in some ways for entrepreneurial reasons.
Rabbi Michael Paley.
This is particularly important because of the rise of mercantilism as an economic view that said that a country's wealth was in its labor as opposed to in its land. That meant, of course, that the more people you had in the country, the richer you were. So to invite Jews in was good public policy. The downside, of course, of mercantilism is slaves. That was the real soft heel of the whole system.
Although the Jews of New York have the right to trade and to serve in the militia, they are only allowed to worship in their homes. They petition many times for the right to build a synagogue. And in 1730, permission is granted to construct Sherith Israel, commonly known as the Spanish and Portuguese Synagogue, the first in North America.
The phrase Sheareth Israel comes from the Bible, and it means the remnant of Israel. It goes back to a prophetic ideal that no matter what happens to the Jewish people, no matter where they're spread out, a remnant of Israel will always be looked over by God.
Congregation Sheareth Israel still exists, though the original building on Mill Street is long gone. So is the street itself. A room at the back of the current synagogue on New York's Central Park West is a replica of the original 1730 building. It's called the Little Synagogue. Dr. Mark Angel is senior rabbi of Sheareth Israel.
Mill Street Synagogue was 35 feet square, and that could house every single Jew in New York City, man, woman, and child.
There were no more than 400 Jews in New York in 1730.
When you go into the Little Synagogue, you'll see most of the artifacts are in fact from 1730 Synagogue. And that'll be the same mood that you would have had if you prayed in New York in 1730. Synagogue's painted the same colors as it was in 1730. During the first decades, the Jewish community was composed primarily of Sephardic Jews. Sephardic means having antecedents in medieval Sepharad, which is Spain, or in the Iberian Peninsula in general.
Very quickly, German and Polish and Eastern European Jews came to America and adopted the Sephardic service.
Ambassador John Loeb is a descendant of Jacob Phillips, who came to Charleston, South Carolina from England in 1699.
Many people think from that era that they were Sephardic because their families from 1654 to 1825 worshipped in Sephardic service. So my grandmother believed that she was totally Sephardic. But in tracing her, most of her family and researching it were really Ashkenazi, Eastern European Jews. But she thought she was Sephardic because she grew up in that atmosphere.
Jews mostly are living in port cities in the colonial period, Savannah, in Charleston, in Philadelphia, in New York, and in Newport.
By 1800, Charleston is the largest Jewish community in America. Eli Evans is an author and a scholar of Southern Jewish history.
The Constitution in Charleston was written by John Locke, John Locke being the philosopher who was the inspiration to Thomas Jefferson and all the founding fathers. It was a document that granted Jews freedom to worship, freedom to vote, to belong in the military, to go in business with non-Jews, in short, to be full citizens. These people had contacts in Europe, and that meant a lot to the colony. So Jews were welcome in Charleston, a unique place.
The colonies varied very much in their attitudes toward religious minorities.
Susan Jacoby.
But one thing in the colonial period that makes something different was all of this space that didn't exist in the old world. So when people like Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson ran afoul of the theocracy of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they just headed out and founded Rhode Island, which also became a state that was very hospitable to Jews.
Jews come to Newport, Rhode Island in the mid-18th century. Most of them are traders. Don Duarte Lopez arrives from Lisbon about 1750. Lopez is a converso, or hidden Jew. He's about 20 years old when he arrives. He immediately drops his Christian name Duarte and takes the Hebrew name Aaron. He also has himself circumcised, a painful procedure in the days before anesthesia. Within 20 years, Aaron Lopez had interests in more than 100 ships. He never allowed his ships to leave the docks on the Sabbath, though he traded pork, along with rum and sugar. By 1761, like most merchants of his time, he traded slaves. At the end of his life, Aaron Lopez was recognized as one of the merchant princes of America. John de Sola Poole is a distant descendant of Aaron Lopez. We met him on a walking tour of colonial Jewish Newport.
Aaron Lopez had a problem. He had an unmarried daughter, Sarah, and there are no nice Jewish boys in Newport and didn't find any in New York and Philadelphia. But he heard about the three Mendes boys down in Jamaica. So he got in touch with Mrs. Pereira Mendes, and she had three sons. And she sent Abraham Pereira Mendes to Newport, and he marries Sarah Lopez, and that's how we solve the problem. Abraham was the brother of my great-great-great-great-grandfather, David.
Again, Jonathan Sarna.
The Jews of Newport become quite wealthy, and they decide that they are going to build a synagogue. And they commission Peter Harrison, a local architect who has built other fine buildings in the New England area. And he builds this little gem of a synagogue in Newport in 1763.
We know a lot about this era because Ezra Stiles, a leading Protestant minister at the time, was fascinated with the Jews, made a great friend of the Jews, and kept a very careful diary.
December 2nd, 1763, Friday. In the afternoon was the dedication of the new synagogue in this town. It began by a handsome procession. The order and decorum, the harmony and solemnity of the music, together with a handsome assembly of people in an edifice the most perfect of the temple kind, perhaps in America, and splendidly illuminated, could not but raise in the mind a faint idea of the majesty and grandeur of the ancient Jewish worship mentioned in Scripture.
The Touro Synagogue has the distinction of being the oldest synagogue still extant in North America. The synagogue is remarkable because in the early 19th century, the Jewish community of Newport evaporates. Newport is wrecked in the Revolution. Its port never regains its former power, and the Jews scatter. As Jews begin to move back to Newport, first as a summer resort, and then as a larger community, the end of the 19th century, the synagogue is reopened, and it is still to this day utilized for Sabbath services.
There were at most 2,500 Jews living in the colonies. They tried to maintain their Jewish traditions while participating fully in the public life of their communities. It was not always easy.
They lead bifurcated lives. They compartmentalize their lives into Jewish and worldly domains.
In 1777, a Hessian soldier fighting for the British was surprised at how well Jews blended in.
There are also many Jews now resident in America who carry on wholesale trade and business and who are not easily distinguishable from Christians.
Some of these Jews actually have different names. One name that they use with their fellow Jews and in the synagogue, and a Spanish name that they seem to use when they're doing business.
The unique thing about America at the time is that Jews from a very early stage were really considered Americans, and therefore they looked and dressed like Americans. Many of our earliest portrait painters, like Thomas Sully and Gilbert Stuart, painted Jews.
We find that colonial portraits of Jews look no different from colonial portraits of their wealthy Protestant neighbors. There is no way that you can tell that these are Jewish merchants.
The Jews, however, are not like the ones we have in Europe and Germany, who are recognizable by their beards and their clothes. But these are dressed like other citizens. They get shaved regularly and also eat pork, although that is forbidden in their law. The women also go about with curled hair and in French finery, such as is worn by the ladies of the other religions. Jews and Christians intermarry without scruple.
It's estimated that the intermarriage rate in the colonial period is about 15%, much smaller than would be true today. But nevertheless, for that time, that was a high number, And we do have an absolutely remarkable set of letters in which Abigail Franks really describes what it meant to her when her daughter left home and ran off with a non-Jewish man named Oliver Delancey.
Good God, what a shock it was. When they acquainted me, she had left the house and had been married 6 months. My house has been my prison ever since.
She wants to withdraw in shame from the community, and yet the neighbors wonder, why is this such a terrible thing?
I had heard the report that she was to be married to Oliver Delancey, but I gave no heed to it further than a general caution of her conduct, which has always been unblemished, and is so still in the eye of the Christians, who allow she has disobliged us, but has in no way been dishonorable, being married to a man of worth and character.
They don't understand why Mama Franks doesn't want to have anything to do with her daughter or her new son-in-law.
I think I've spun this to a considerable length and shall conclude with a repetition of my prayers for your health and happiness. I am, my dear son, your affectionate mother, Abigail Franks. Flatbush, Tuesday, June 7th, 1743.
Jews in America were always concerned that America might be a land that was good for Jews, but bad for Judaism. A place where they might find economic success, but where it would be difficult for them to preserve their religion. In some ways, I think the fear that Jews will not survive has helped to ensure that they do.
You're listening to The First Jews. I'm Larry Josephson. We'll be back in a minute.